Welcome to Hallel Fellowship, found on the internet at hallel.info. That's hallel.info. We hope you are encouraged by the following recorded Bible study to look deeper into every word that proceeds from the mouth of God and how they were lived out in the life of Yeshua HaMashiach, often called Jesus the Christ.
This is Deuteronomy starting in chapter 11 and verse 26 through chapter 16 to verse 17. So Deuteronomy 11, chapter 11, verse 26. See, I present before you today a blessing and a curse. The blessing that you hearken to the commandments of the Lord your God that I command you today, and the curse if you do not hearken to the commandments of the Lord your God and you stray from the path that I command you today, to follow other gods that you did not know. It shall be that when the Lord your God brings you to a land which you come to possess it, then you shall deliver the blessing on Mount Gerizim and the curse on Mount Ebal. Are they not on the other side of the Jordan, far in the direction of the sunset, and the land of the Canaanite that dwells in the plain, far from Gilgal, near the plains of Moreh? For you are across the Jordan to come and possess the land the Lord your God gives you. You shall possess it, you shall settle it. You shall be careful to perform all the decrees and the ordinances that I present before you today. These are the decrees and the ordinances that you are to observe to perform in the land the Lord your God of your fathers has given you, to possess it all the days you live on the land. You shall utterly destroy all the places where the nations that you are driving away worship to their gods, on the high mountains and on the hills, and under every leafy tree. You shall break apart their altars, you shall smash their pillars, and their sacred trees you shall burn in the fire. Their carved images shall you cut down, and you shall obliterate their names from that place. You shall not do this to the Lord your God, rather only at the place the Lord your God will choose from among all your tribes to place his name. There you shall seek out his presence and come there. And there shall you bring your burnt offerings and feast offerings, your tithes, and what you raise up with your hand, your vow offerings, your freewill offerings, and the firstborn of your cattle and your flocks. You shall eat there before the Lord your God, and you shall rejoice with every undertaking, you and your household, as the Lord your God has blessed you. You shall not do like everything we do here today, rather every man what is proper in his eyes. For you will not yet have come into the resting place, or the heritage the Lord your God gives you. You shall cross the Jordan and settle it in the land the Lord your God caused you to inherit. He will give you the rest from all your enemies all around, and you will dwell securely. It shall be the place the Lord your God will choose to rest, his name. There shall you bring everything that I command you, your burnt offerings, your feast offerings, your tithes, and what you raise up with your hands, and the choicest of your vow offerings that you will vow to the Lord. You shall rejoice before the Lord your God, you, your sons, your daughters, your slaves, your maidservants, the Levite who is within your cities, for he has no share and inheritance with you. Beware for yourself, lest you bring up your burnt offerings in any place that you see, rather only in the place that the Lord will choose, among one of your tribes. There shall you bring up your burnt offerings, and there shall you do all I command you. However, in your soul's desire you may slaughter and eat meat, according to the blessing the Lord your God will have given you in all your cities. The contaminated one and the pure one may eat it, like the deer and the hart. But you shall not eat the blood. You are to pour it onto the earth like water. In your outlying cities you may not eat the tithe of your grain and your wine in your city, in your oil. The firstborn of your cattle, your flocks, and all your vow offerings that you vow, and your freewill offerings, and what you raise up with your hands. Rather, you shall eat them before the Lord your God in the place the Lord your God will choose. You, your son, your daughter, your slave, your maidservant, and the Levite who is in your cities. And you shall rejoice with the Lord your God in your every undertaking. Beware for yourself, lest you forsake the Levite all your days on your land. When the Lord your God will broaden your boundary as he spoke to you, and you say, I would eat meat, for you will have a desire to eat meat, to your heart's desire, may you eat meat. If the place where the Lord your God will choose to place his name will be far from you, you may slaughter from your cattle and your flocks that the Lord has given you, as I have commanded you. You may eat it in your cities according to your heart's entire desire. Even as the deer and the hart are eaten, so may you eat it. The contaminated one and the pure one may eat it together. Only be strong not to eat the blood, for the blood is the soul, and you shall not eat the soul with the meat. You shall not eat it, you shall pour it onto the ground like water. You shall not eat it, in order that it will be well with you and your children after you, when you do what is right in the eyes of the Lord. Only your sanctities that you will have and your vow offerings that you will carry and come to the place the Lord your God will choose. You shall perform your burnt offerings, the flesh and the blood, upon the altar of the Lord your God, and the blood of your feast offerings shall be poured upon the altar of the Lord your God, and you shall eat the flesh. Safeguard and hearken to all these words I command you, in order that it will be well with you and your children after you forever, when you do what is good and right in the eyes of the Lord your God. When the Lord your God will cut down the nations to which you come to take possession from them before you, and you will take possession from them and settle in their land, beware for yourself, lest you be attracted after them, and after they have been destroyed before you, lest you seek out their gods, saying, how did these nations worship their gods? And even I will do the same. You shall not do so to the Lord your God, for everything that is an abomination to the Lord that he hates, have they done to their gods. For even their sons, their daughters, have they burned in the fire to their gods. Chapter 13. The entire word that I command you shall observe, you shall not add to it, and you shall not subtract from it. If there should stand up in your midst a prophet or a dreamer of dreams, he will produce to you a sign or a wonder, and the sign or wonder comes about, of which he spoke to you, saying, let us follow gods of the others that you did not know, and we shall worship them. Do not hearken to the words of that prophet or that dreamer of dreams. The Lord your God is testing you to know whether you love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul. Lord your God shall you follow, and in him shall you fear. His commandments shall you observe, and to his voice shall you hearken. Him shall you serve, and to him shall you cleave. And the prophet and that dreamer of dreams shall you put to death, for he had spoken perversion against the Lord your God, who takes you out of the land of Egypt, and he redeems you from the house of slavery, to make you stray from the path on which the Lord your God has commanded you to go, and you shall destroy the evil from your midst. If your brother, the son of your mother, the son of your daughter, or the wife of your bosom, or your friend who is like you, your own soul, will entice you secretly, saying, let us go and worship the gods of others, that you did not know, you or your fathers, from the gods of the people that are all around you, those near to you or those far from you, from one end of the earth to the other end of the earth, you shall not accede to him and not hearken to him. Your eyes shall not take pity on him. You shall not be compassionate nor conceal him, whether you shall surely kill him. Your hand shall be the first against him to kill him, and the hand of the entire people afterwards. You shall pelt him with stones, and he shall die. For he sought to make you stray from near the Lord your God, who takes you out of Egypt from the house of slavery. All Israel shall hear and fear, and they shall not again do such an evil thing in your midst. If in one of your cities the Lord your God gives you, into which you will dwell, you hear saying, lawless men have emerged from your midst, and they have caused the dwellers of the city to go astray, saying, let us go and worship the gods of others that you have not known. You shall seek out and investigate and inquire well. Behold, if it is true, the word is correct, this abomination was committed in your midst, you shall surely smite the inhabitants of that city with the edge of the sword. Lay it waste, everything that is in it, and its animals with the edge of the sword. You shall gather together all its bounty through the midst of the open square, and you shall burn it in fire completely, the city and its bounty, to the Lord your God, and it shall be an eternal heap. It shall not be rebuilt. No part of the banned property may adhere to your hand, so the Lord will turn back from his burning wrath, and he will give you mercy and merciful to you and multiply you, as he swore to your forefathers. When you hearken to the voice of the Lord your God, to observe all his commandments that I command you today, to do what is right in the eyes of the Lord your God. Chapter 14. You are children to the Lord your God. You shall not cut yourselves, and you shall not make a bald spot between your eyes for a dead person. For you are a holy people to the Lord your God, and the Lord has chosen you for himself to be a treasured people from among all the peoples on the face of the earth. You shall not eat any abomination. These are the animals that you may eat: the ox, the sheep, the goat, the hart, the deer, and the yakmir, the yako, the dishon, the tio, and the zamir. Every animal that has a split hoof, which is completely separated in two parts, that brings up its cud among animals, it you may eat. But this you shall not eat from among those animals that bring up their cud, or have a completely separated split hoof, the camel, the hare, the hyrax, for they bring up their cud, but their hoof is not split. They are unclean for you. And the pig, for it has a split hoof, but not the cud. It is unclean to you. From their flesh you shall not eat. You shall not touch their carcasses. This you may eat of everything that is in the water. Any that has fins and scales you may eat. And it does not have fins or scales, you shall not eat. It is unclean to you. Every clean bird you may eat. This is what you shall not eat from among them: the nesher, the perez, the osnia, the ra'ah, the ayah, the dayah, according to its kind, every orev, according to its kind, the bas, pronounce the word right, the bas hayana, the tachmos, shachaf, the nets, according to its kind, the kos, the yansuf, and the tishmeres, the kas and the rachma, the shalach, the chasida, the anafa, according to its kind, the duchifas, and the atelef. And every flying, swarming creature is unclean to you. They shall not be eaten. Every clean bird you may eat. You shall not eat any carcass that dies of itself. To the stranger who is in your cities, you shall give it, that he may eat it, or sell to a Gentile. For you are a holy people to the Lord your God. You shall not cook a kid in its mother's milk. You shall tithe the entire crop of your planting, the produce of the field, year by year, and you shall eat before the Lord your God in the place that he will choose to rest his name there. The tithe of your grain, your wine, your oil, the firstborn of your cattle, and your flocks, so you will learn to fear the Lord your God all your days. If the road will be too long for you, so that you cannot carry it, because the place the Lord your God will choose to place his name is far from you, or the Lord your God will have blessed you, then you may exchange it for money. Wrap up the money in your hand and go to the place the Lord your God will choose. You may spend the money for whatever your heart desires, for cattle, for flock, for wine or similar drink, for anything that your soul wishes. You shall eat it there before the Lord your God and rejoice, you and your household. You shall not forsake the Levite who is in your cities, for he has no portion or inheritance with you. At the end of the third year, you shall take out every tithe of your crop in that year and set it down within your cities. Then the Levite can come, for he has no portion or inheritance with you, the proselyte, the orphan, the widow who are in your cities, so they may eat and be satisfied, in order that the Lord your God will bless you in all your handiwork and you may undertake. Chapter 15. At the end of 7 years, you shall institute a remission. This is the matter of remission. Every creditor shall remit his authority over what he has lent his fellow. He shall not press his fellow or his brother, for he has proclaimed a remission to the Lord. You may press the Gentile, but over what you have with your brother, you shall remit all your authority. However, may there be no institute or destitute among you Rather, the Lord will surely bless you in the land the Lord your God will give you as an inheritance to possess it. Only if you will hearken to the voice of the Lord your God to observe, to perform this entire commandment that I command you today. The Lord your God has blessed you, and he has told you, you will lend to many nations, but you will not borrow. You will dominate many nations, but they will not dominate you. If there shall be a destitute person among you, any of your brethren in any of your cities, in your land the Lord your God gives you, you shall not harden your heart, nor close your hand against your destitute brother. Rather, you shall open your hand to him. You shall lend him his requirement, whatever is lacking to him. Beware, at least there be a lawless thought in your heart, saying, the seventh year approaches, the remission year. And you will look malevolently upon your destitute brother and refuse to give him. When he may appeal against you to the Lord, it will be a sin against you. You shall surely give him, and let your heart not feel bad when you give to him. For in return for this matter, the Lord your God will bless you in all your deeds and in every undertaking. For destitute people will not cease to exist within the land. Therefore I command you, saying, you shall surely open your hands to your brother, to your poor, and to your destitute in your land. If your brother, a Hebrew man or Hebrew woman, will be sold to you, he shall serve you 6 years. The seventh year, you shall send him away from you free. But when you send him away from you free, you shall not send away him away empty-handed. Adorn him generously from your flocks and from your threshing floor, from your wine cellar. As the Lord your God has blessed you, so shall you give to him. You shall remember that you were a slave in the land of Egypt. The Lord your God redeemed you. Therefore, I command you regarding this matter today. In the event, he will say to you, I will not leave you, for he loves you and your household, for it is good for him with you. Then you shall take the awl and put it through his ear at the door, and he shall be for you an eternal slave. Even to your maidservant shall you do the same. It shall not be difficult in your eyes when you send him away free from you. For twice the wage of a hired hand, 6 years has he served you. Lord your God will bless you in all that you do. Every firstborn male that is born in your cattle and your flock, you shall sanctify to the Lord your God. You shall not work with the firstborn of your ox, nor shall you shear the firstborn of your flock. For the Lord your God shall you eat it, year by year, and the place the Lord will choose, you and your household. If it shall have a blemish, lameness or blindness, or any serious blemish, you shall not slaughter it to the Lord your God. In your cities shall you eat it, the contaminated one and the pure one alike, just like the deer and the hart. However, you shall not eat its blood. You shall pour it out the ground like water. Chapter 16. You shall observe the month of Aviv to perform the Pesach offering to the Lord your God. In the month of the springtime, the Lord your God took you out of the light of Egypt at night. You shall slaughter the Pesach offering to the Lord your God from the flock, or also the cattle, in the place where the Lord will choose to rest his name. You shall not eat leavened bread with it. For 7 days shall you eat matzot because of it, the bread of affliction. For you departed from the land of Egypt in haste, so that you will remember the day of your departure from the land of Egypt all the days of your life. No leaven of yours shall be seen throughout your boundary for 7 days, nor shall any of the flesh that you slaughter on the afternoon before the first day shall remain overnight until morning. You may not slaughter the Pesach offering in one of your cities that the Lord your God gives you, except at the place that the Lord your God will choose to rest his name. There shall you slaughter the Pesach offering in the afternoon, as the sun descends, the appointed time of your departure from Egypt. You shall roast it and eat it in the place the Lord your God will choose. In the morning you may turn back and go to your tents. For a 6 day period you shall eat matzot, and on the 7th day shall be an assembly to the Lord your God. You shall not perform labor. You shall count 7 weeks for yourselves, from when the sickle is first put to the standing crop shall you begin counting 7 weeks. Then you shall observe the festival of Shavuot, the Lord your God. The voluntary offerings that you give should be commensurate with how much the Lord your God will have blessed you. You shall rejoice with the Lord your God, you, your son, your daughter, your slave, your maidservant, the Levite who is in your cities, the proselyte, the orphan, and the widow who are among you. In the place that the Lord your God will choose to rest his name, shall you remember that you were a slave in Egypt, and you shall observe and perform these decrees. You shall make the festival of Sukkot for a 7-day period when you gather in from your threshing floor and from your wine cellar. You shall rejoice in your festival, you, your son, your daughter, your slave, your maidservant, the Levite, the proselyte, the orphan, and the widow who are in your cities. A 7-day period shall you celebrate the Lord your God in the place the Lord your God will choose, for the Lord will have blessed you in all your crop, in all your handiwork, and you will be completely joyous. 3 times a year all your males shall appear before the Lord your God in the place that he will choose, on the festival of Matzot, the festival of Shavuot, the festival of Sukkot. And you shall not appear before the Lord empty-handed. Everyone according to what we can give, according to the blessing the Lord your God gives to you. A lot of reading. Hold on. Before I go my little spiel, any comments, questions, or things I could answer for you regarding this section? That was Deuteronomy from 11, verse 26 through chapter 16, verse 17. Yes, Anne.
You read the animals' names in Hebrew.
Yes, I did.
I'm sure there's purpose in that.
There's a few. There's a few different names in there. They have reasons why they're written in Hebrew. The reason why, well, a lot of texts have different ways of writing it. The English translations are not wrong, but they're not accurate either. In that there's a few items that are open up to interpretation on the actual animal species. For example, most your English texts, I believe it is verse, where is it? Get the right chapter here. Food. The animals that are clean, you have the wild goat. It's verse 5 of chapter 14. Most English text says the deer, the gazelle, the roe deer, and the wild goat. The mountain goat, the antelope, the mountain sheep. The word wild goat, zamer, it can also be giraffe. So it depends on what your translation is. Wild goat's what you think in English, but giraffe is also equally correct. And giraffes have split hooves and they chew their cud. So they are legitimately clean animals, but we don't know which what. So because it says wild goat in English and no one really knows, is it actually a wild goat? And what's the difference between a wild goat and a mountain goat? I don't really know. To me, they're all wild. Because we don't know the precise definition, they left it in Hebrew, say, hey, figure out yourself. These are the Hebrew words. You determine whether it's one or the other. Yes.
A couple of things. Okay. Your book said a bald spot before your eyes.
Right.
And so I can only guess, but I would like to have your opinion. Then touch the carcass of a pig.
Touch the carcass of an unclean animal in general, or touch a carcass of an animal that died of itself. Clean or unclean makes a difference.
Oh.
Right, so there's two different categories of unclean
animals. Yeah, because I had a pet pig, you know, the miniature pig.
Right.
And also a tithe on the third year. I want to have you
explain that.
I will discuss that.
Yes.
Oh yeah, that has to be real good. And then I forgot the question. Because you will learn to fear the Lord your God, you have to give up your cattle.
Right. The process of the tithing process and how it works, it is designed in order for us to understand the importance of God and how he intends us for us to use that.
Yeah, I got the impression that they want you to tithe when you think you haven't got anything.
You always have something.
Give it even if it looks like you have a little.
Right.
We'll
discuss the more details about tithing and how the Bible defines what is tithable and what is not tithable items. We'll discuss that shortly.
Yeah, I want you to just, like 72, let's just do somebody with, like what category, like for us today, how does it apply to us? Like somebody who's on disability and
Right, all those details.
We'll
discuss that. Okay. I'm trying to find myself down to a short period of time today, so I won't cover everything, but I'll cover that subject matter as well as a few others. Yes, Carrie.
I'm only semi-serious in saying this for effect, but how come we haven't killed Benny Hinn?
Wait, say that again?
How come we haven't killed Benny Hinn? Well, it's talking about sentencing prophets to death if they're not, if false prophets or things like that.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, my own opinion, we live in a country where that's not allowed, but.
Yeah, there are rules. There's trial required too. No, it says that when a false prophet or whatever comes along, don't have pity on them. There's no pity. There's no, oh, well, here's, no, he specifically says you do not show mercy on this individual. There are lots of applications to show mercy on people. A murderer, a thief, a robber, a liar. But mercy has an application. On someone who's deliberately trying to avoid and redirect you away from God, zero mercy. So that's given. But you have to have a trial. You have to investigate. I can't say, you know what, that guy, I really don't like him. Guess what? He said such and such. Oh, look, he's dead. Oh, bummer. No, that calls me, I'm a murderer then. So there has to be an investigation, multiple witnesses. In the text later on, I think it's chapter, latter half of 13? I could be wrong. Actually middle of 13. What it says is when that witnesses for hey, this whole city, there's a belief system that's been spread, and this city now has people who are going away from God, and they've been taught. Well, there's obviously actions there. So there was somebody who convinced them otherwise, and they didn't do their job of wiping out the individual who was a liar, and thus it spread. And the community's job then is to wipe out the city and all of its possessions, which is, we seem, wow, that's really harsh. Well, God's really, really keen on the fact that what happens when you take other pagan practices and start meshing them together? Well, you get what happens in called our whole Bible. Of the entire book of Kings and the Chronicles and the prophets of how horrible these people have become of sacrificing their own children. That's what happens. And God said, I would rather have you dead now than your children murdered later. Kill you now so I don't have to deal with you. I'll deal with you later. I don't want that progression to continue on and spread out like a cancer, start killing everybody else off because of your actions. It's better off for a millstone hung around a man's neck versus harm a little one. So God's, your progeny, your continue on generations are more valuable to him, no offense to everybody here, than we are. and I say that purposefully because God's kingdom is made up of human beings, not of stuff. And if we take away his inheritance as human beings, we kill them all off, then what's God's kingdom left with? Air. Nothing. Nothing there. So his inheritance, the kingdom he builds, is built on people. That's who we are. So that's what he's trying to gather together. If we wipe out chunks early on or curse generations later by our actions of misguiding and purposely manipulating individuals along the way, you're stealing from God. You're stealing his inheritance, his kingdom from him. He doesn't take kindly to it. Any comments? Yes, Pat.
Could you go more into the Levites in the city? Are all Levites did not serve at the temple? Or
right. Most did not. Very few Levites actually served the temple. I say very few because obviously Aaron and his immediate descendants were, the Levites were broken up into multiple different camps. But as the texts in other areas show us, Levites were also scattered amongst different cities. We call them Levites. Their job, their function was to bridge the gap between an ordinary citizen and their understanding and belief and worship of God. Well, if I live, you know, 200 miles away versus 2 miles away from Jerusalem, I'm not going to have the same experience or understanding. I won't see the Levites going in and out of the temple every week and what happens and all the sacrifices and all the prayers and all the different things happen. I won't participate in that if I'm too far away from it. So Levites being scattered around, the whole intention was that they would be the instructors, the guides, the teachers, to take care of your sacrifices, your offerings, and do the prayers. Make sure the altar is done right so that you and your children have an experience understanding what God is about. In the text here, it points out, I believe it's in chapter, where is it? Chapter 12. And it discusses your personal offerings, your personal altar versus the national altar. You can do certain things on your personal altar, which is your free will offerings, your general offerings to God, and do not involve sin or holy days or first of your flock. There are other items which you are allowed to offer. Well, Levites are near you. That's their job. Take care of these offerings which you're offering to God. But When you have to do with sins or holy days, you have to travel the whole way, all the way to where the temple is. It has to be done there. Sins are not done on your altar. They're only done there. And that's the distinction. We want to separate what people do in their individual lives versus what they do as a community and with God. Your relationship with God has to be a particular method or way. He wants it on his altar versus your relationship with community is all on your own. That makes sense? So the Levites around you are dealing with this community relationship that you have. The Levites at the temple, their job is to, okay, everybody, your sins, bring them in. Let's see if we can get God to take care of this and clean you up. Once, well, not just once a year. You can do it. It's at least once a year, but it's usually multiple times a year, typically three times a year, each holy day which you show up. Yes, Tammy.
Now, on that topic, the Jewish Study Bible, I think it was, actually refers to it. They use the terminology sacred sacrifice, you know, which is to be done in the place God commands, versus what they use the term secular slaughter, which would basically be what the animals we'd slaughter for food. And then also goes into the thing about, you know, if you hunt wild game and how to process that and all that. Mm-hmm. You know, because normally you don't sacrifice wild
game. Normally you wouldn't. And they did, which is generally true. The one thing I did have issue with them is the way in which they discussed your normal food sacrifice, which they instruct to do, you pour the blood on the ground like you would a wild deer which you caught. But you still are allowed offerings on your altars, which you would never offer those things for any reason. They're not offered items. But you are still allowed to have offerings, your personal offerings, that have nothing to do with your sacrifices that are dealing with sins, transgressions, iniquities, all that stuff that happens over the temple. So there still has to be an altar, so it is an altar they're using. And it has the ones that you lifted up. You lifted up altars, which is your free will offerings, that are not based for sin, not based for sacrifice because you did something wrong, or not holiday based. None of that. Those are just free will offerings, saying, "God, thanks. Here you go." Those type of free will offerings. Those are permitted at your own altar. Anything else is not. They have to the main altar inside the city. But in general, it's mostly for food, which is most commonly used. You could still do an olah offering, a whole burnt up offering, on your personal altar, because no one eats it. But those also are not holy offerings. I mean, they're not designed for holy days, or for sins, transgressions, iniquities, or first of your flocks. Any of those categories, which are only at the main temple. Make that make sense? They do distinguish the little subtle differences, but they are important. And what happens with those offerings which you're eating for food, you treat them like you would the deer, like you would a gazelle, like anything else you hunt. It is no different than those animals. Even though it's a sheep, it doesn't matter. You treat it like you would a deer. You slaughter it, pour the blood out, bury it, kick a little dust on it, whatever is required, skin it, cook it, eat it. That's how the process works. Well, hopefully you skin it first. Fish you, guess you don't. Yes.
Okay, pour the blood out.
Yes, like water.
What about eating meat in a restaurant here in town that's only cooked medium rare?
Okay. Nitty-gritties. When it comes to what you personally do, that's for you and God. My hands are off. I can't say what you should or shouldn't do on that. As a general rule, science has their screwed up things, and they have some things they did actually reasonably okay. In the definition, when science defines blood, they define purposefully it not the same substance inside the muscle that people eat, because there's an ingredient missing. Though it's the same color. So science have claimed that one's blood and one, because hemoglobin is the distinction. One it has it, one doesn't. And the meat juices, if you use that term loosely, the red stuff inside the meat that's not in the arteries, scientists claim that's not actually blood. Whether it is or isn't, that's your business. Most individuals who are trying to avoid blood eating at restaurants, trying to avoid it, don't eat it rare. Because when you cook a meat all the way, the blood is forced to the surface. Because the meat, if you notice, most of you have cooked meat before, right? What happens to meat? It starts contracting. It gets tougher. What's it doing? It's pushing blood out. And other juices out too, but it's pushing those things out. So if somebody who believes that is blood inside the meat, I'm not saying it isn't, and they're trying to avoid it in a restaurant, they're saying, well done. It's doable. if that's what an individual believes. But that's a person's choice, not my decision to make. Yes, John.
Okay, so I was under the understanding, correct me if I'm wrong, or whatever, is that when the animal is slaughtered kosher and the throat is cut, the blood is drained, that satisfies
the theory.
Blood?
I didn't want to go into all details about kosher slaughter, but there are three main arteries, three main tubes in a throat of most clean animals. You have the most arteries, and there's like the esophagus and tracheal tube, and then I'm doing a front view. Let's see, there's an animal. Here's a head, ears. That's part of his neck. Here's a mouth. It has arteries that you're slicing, the esophagus or tracheal tube you're slicing. Kosher slaughter, its rule is single swipe, make a single cut, a long knife, preferably, because the animal's usually relatively big. You cannot touch the bone in any part of the body. You can't touch the jawbone, can't touch the neck bone, none of the bones can be touched in the process of slaughter. So their point, their objective in kosher slaughter is to slice all three, the artery, or both arteries, and the esophageal tracheal tube, slice them all in one slice. The objective is to try and to kill the animal relatively quickly, as well as dump as much blood off as they possibly can. Now, in most animals, this isn't really required. It's actually quite simple to kill most animals that don't require the massive slice on all of them. God didn't say you shall slice the whole thing off without touching the bone. It's not part of it. That's what men have decided in kosher slaughter. In most animals, with the exception being the cow, most animals, here's my animal, has a tube. They have the arteries. The arteries are near the surface, which the alternate kosher slaughter, which is a competing camp, believes, I don't need to slice all of this, and I'll tell you why in a minute. I can just slice this artery and this artery and let the animal fall asleep. Meanwhile, its heart is pumping the blood out to its ground. This works for all animals except cattle, because the arteries in cattle are much deeper. They're hard to actually get to. Now, if I was a veterinarian, I would tell you that's garbage. I can get to them quite easily. But I'm not a vet. Vets have a method of getting these arteries to the surface. It's a way in which you squeeze the neck in a certain way, and the arteries are forced to the surface. But I'm not a veterinarian. I don't know how to do it, but they can do it. This method is considered acceptable, too. The reason why these people don't like the whole massive slice people is that if you ever watch an animal go through this process, you will note, oh, they're suffocating. You never eat an animal that's suffocated. You have to kill it, not suffocate it. And so people who argue that you can't slice it all the way through because the animal's clearly gasping for air, that this doesn't seem right. And thus they argue that just slice the two arteries instead, because the animal continues to breathe, gets tired, and falls asleep. It seems better. What you like, what I like, who cares? That's what the arguments are. I won't say one's right or wrong, it's what they're doing. You could argue that, hey, you know, one's been done for umpteen hundred thousand billion years, one's done for a shorter time, who cares? It doesn't matter how long it's been done. It just matters of men's opinions. The whole point is they want the blood spilled on the ground because that's where the life of the animal is. That's what God wants. And as far as how it's spilled and whether one group says it should be this way, one group says it should be that way, if that was true and it has to be one of these two ways, tell me, how do I eat a deer? Go up to a deer and slit its throat. Yeah, good luck. Try to get near a deer to slit its throat. How do I eat any of the wild game that I'm allowed to eat? Well, apparently I wouldn't, because you couldn't catch them. I mean, those of you who are good hunters and can trap the animal, wow, I'm impressed. Most others use bows and arrows or guns. That's been the most common way of killing an animal. You wouldn't be able to do either of those methods on the game that exists in the world that God said you can eat, like the deer and the gazelle, because they are not compatible with these methods of slaughter. Yes, Carrie.
Well, and from what I've heard, that would kind of defeat the purpose, because isn't part of this slaughtering debate about not having too much adrenaline being pumped through the animal? So with wild game,
it has full of adrenaline.
You really want to kill them before they even know you're there.
Essentially, yeah. In that methodology. Now, in this, then that's the whole point of the pouring the blood out. They want the blood poured out. However you do it, they want the blood poured out. And that's where science came and said, well, I poured the blood out, the arteries are empty, but there's still residual blood in the meat. Honestly, there's residual in our skin, too. Cut yourself and find out what happens. It's on the surface. Blood's everywhere. But how will you remove it or how it's been removed? You have to decide how it's good to remove in your opinion, your case. In most Jewish opinions, after you slaughtered the animal, you have to soak the meat in salt. Smother it in kosher salt on both sides, because salt, as most of us know, sucks moisture out like crazy. And yeah, exactly, it will suck up all the blood and everything else out of it before you cook it. And so that's the alternate way of, or a alternate way, that is the common way in which they've killed the animal, they pour the blood out, but now it's soaked in salt, which is no blood left in the meat, and then cook it medium rare, because there's no blood left anyway. And that's fine too. And go ahead and do so. But otherwise, I can't control what a restaurant does. Neither can you or anybody else, because it takes time to do that kind of method. Yes?
Daniel, how do they kill cows?
In the kosher slaughter, as I discussed, they take the entire thing and swipe the whole thing as quickly as they possibly can. All the esophagus is taken as well as the arteries. In the other methodology, which I told you before, there's two methods. They call it the bolt method, which is they take the animal's head, sit it in the fixture, and it's doing whatever, and they press with a hydraulic press a bolt about yay big in size right to the animal's head, straight down. They're basically designed to crush the head, or the brain. The intent is the animal dies in a few seconds. Problem is, it doesn't usually. But they say it does. It really doesn't. But they say it does. The method number two, you shoot it with a gun. The second method number two. Take a gun and shoot the head. Are either of those God's way? No, God didn't say how to kill an animal. He didn't specify that. He just said that drain the blood. Don't eat the blood, steal the blood. He didn't say you have to kill it this way or that way. I'm not going to get into a long argument regarding, well, there's the oral law and blah, blah. Garbage. Because you can see that stuff written down in people's arguments in old textbooks. Okay, obviously they disagree with the oral law if they're disagreeing with it. So it can't be written down somewhere. It's not an oral law if people disagree with how it's done. So clearly it's not an oral law, it's a made-up law. So how it's done wasn't discussed. Now there's an example that says you will do things the way I've shown you, God said to Moses, the way I showed you. Well, he described almost everything he showed us right here. So it's pretty well described. So the method that says you must do this way or that way, it doesn't specify. It just says the blood poured on the ground. That's why both kosher methods, you can argue one versus the other. Enjoy your argument. Have fun. I don't really care. It's your decision. And I can't tell you what's right or wrong because the Bible doesn't say you shall slit its throat completely or you shall shoot it in the head. It doesn't specify the methodology. Modern methods of killing animal with the bolt method, which is very, very, very common throughout most of restaurants, they buy their meat from cattle that's in feedlots or even not feedlots. They're slaughtered. That's the way they're slaughtered. It's the most common method of slaughtering. It's very fast, very clean. I use the term clean loosely because it's still messy. It's a messy process. Cattle? The cattle's there. It discusses cattle. The clean animals. The ox is part of the cattle family, which is in chapter... Where is it? Animals, yeah, every clean... The ox is there too. Everything else is split hoof. The ox, the sheep, the goat. So the ox is part of the cattle family, which includes bison, water buffalo, obviously cows. We'll be familiar with cows and different species thereof. Yaks are included as well in the ox because they're a type of ox. Any other questions regarding this topic so far? Okay. I'm going to go through some of these sections rather quickly because I want to cover certain details before I go into our new moon, give you a few minutes break and go to new moon. First of all, start with chapter 11, just a few verses there. We'll jump through this relatively fast. In verse 27, the blessing and the curse, verse 26 says, I present for you a blessing and a curse, a blessing that you hearken to the commands of the Lord your God that I command you today, and the curse, if you do not hearken to the commands of the Lord your God. Everything in God's eyes, as far as the Bible is concerned, is either a blessing or a curse. You either do it, or you don't do it. You're either blessed from it or you're not blessed from it. But the key is, it's your choice. It's your choice. You choose. You either, as he points out here, the curse if you do not, the blessing if you hearken, the curse if you do not hearken. You have to choose to listen and follow, or choose not to listen and follow. No middle of the roads. No, well, I kind of listened once, then I didn't listen, I listened again. No, you either choose or you don't choose. You want the blessing, you choose. You don't want the blessing, choose the other direction. It's a choice. Every relationship we have with God is always based on a choice. Every animal you eat, kosher and wise, is based on a choice. Every tithe you offer, every holiday you observe, is based on choice. We always choose. And then God will bless according to our choices and how we run those lives. So let's see. Let's move forward a little bit. So all these basic choice, of course, Mount Ebal and Gerizim, which we'll discuss as they get there. I think they're in Joshua, actually. Joshua gets there. We won't cover the Torah study in the Torah study section. But Joshua gets to Mount Ebal and Gerizim. There's two different mountains. One's lush and green. One's bald, actually. There's not much there. Mostly rock. A few flowers grow, but not much. Those are the opposite, the cursing that's just supposed to be. Give a visual example of what is a blessing, what is a cursing. So the people, they're setting two mountains between near Shechem. When Joshua rattles off these blessings and cursings, the people on the blessed side, well, yes, may we be blessed. The people cursed side, yes, may we be cursed. So they understand the differences of what is important, what's not. But it's still based on choice. All right. And let's move forward a little bit further. So chapter 12. But most of this section, of course, is still discussing the idea of what it is to have a false god versus a true god, and how you observe and how you handle the first and second commandments that of the Ten Commandments. Let's see, chapter 12, in verse 3, this is a controversial belief system, but it's technically true. So you shall break the pot, their altars of your false gods. You shall smash the pillars, sacred trees, you shall burn the fire, the carvings you shall cut down. You shall obliterate their names from that place. How do you obliterate a name? How do you obliterate someone's name? Never mention it again. Never mention it again. Remember that the one guy who died, 100 years ago? Yeah, him? Who knows his name? Who cares? I didn't mention it. You don't know who it is. Neither do I. Just some guy. So it doesn't matter. Now, I may reference an individual. Here's the difference. You're actually mentioning a name and referencing a name. So mentioning a name is you identify, oh, the god of such and such, name such and such. Or a reference of a name. Oh, you're a Baal worshiper, aren't you? No, wait a minute. Baal, that's a pagan god's name. Actually, it's title more than name. But still, I just mentioned it. Well, but I'm also instructor, too, teaching people about stuff. Do I not mention the name, or do I mention the name? There's a distinction between obliterating a name and referencing a name. There's a difference. Because I can obliterate a name, meaning never mention it again, or I can teach you a name, because it meant something about a reference, somebody else was doing something right or wrong. Teaching has nothing to do with obliterating. If I want to obliterate something, that has nothing to do with me teaching about it. What matters is what I teach. If I teach anyone methods by which to observe this individual, this pagan idol, pagan, guess what? I just became an evil or a false teacher. If I teach you how evil this individual was and how they're not to be observed in any way, shape, or form, what did I do? I referenced them, but I didn't instruct you to do anything regarding it. Rather, I instructed you the opposite. Avoid the evil. So I still mentioned the name. That's the way which you obliterate the name. It's not by never mentioning it in a teaching format. It's never mentioned it in the instructional format, meaning how to do something. Don't instruct. You teach about versus instructing how to do something. It's like a how-to book versus, you know, making a reference to something. So there's a difference between how you're doing stuff. Now, there are some individuals who will say they will not pronounce the name in their teaching either. Instead, they spell it. I don't know if it's better or worse. I'm a bad speller. If I want to spell it, I'll know it then. So that's not so good. But it's people's opinions. To me, I reference the name because it meant something. So-and-so was a Baal worshiper, and he did this, and he did that, and he was how evil this guy was. Well, it's a reference. I'm telling you how bad the person was, and this is what they did. I'm not saying everybody should go worship Baal. So there's a difference on how you teach versus obliterate and what that meant. Let's see here. Verse 12, also in verse 5 and 6, and other places, you shall not do these various names and these various things that they do. Do the Lord your God. Rather, only the place the Lord your God will choose from among all your tribes. You shall place his name, you shall seek out his presence, and it shall come. You shall bring your burnt offerings, your feast offerings, your tithes, whatever you raise up with your hand, your vow offerings, your freewill offerings, the firstborn of your cattle, your flocks. Eat there for the Lord your God. You shall rejoice with him. Every undertaking you do in your household, the Lord has blessed you. So all of our method, all of our style of doing things, whether we're praying, whether we're praising, whether we're offering something to God, whether we're teaching, whether we're guiding anybody else to do something right, or guiding our children along, it's all directed toward where God put us to do it. And that means, it translates to or adds, don't modify it. Don't take what somebody else does and how they worship their God and say, oh, that's the good idea. I'll bring that in how I worship mine. Bad move. That's not a direction that God wants it done. When we bring a methodology or a technique from one religion and bring it into ours, say, that sounds good. It isn't. God instructed the way he wanted something done. We may not understand why, how, what the reasons are. He doesn't want anything else added to it. Most likely, he knows where it came from, because he's God. But either way, he doesn't want us to add, because that's adding or subtracting a methodology or a way which you ought to worship God. This topic came up multiple times here in our congregation regarding our dancing, because we dance when we worship and praise God. People say, oh, well, you shouldn't dance, because the pagans dance to their God. Thus, you are adapting dancing. That's garbage. The Bible instructs us that dancing was also God-commanded, too. So dancing can't be commanded by God, but brought in from the pagans. That means God's instructing you to take them from pagans. No. Dancing is dancing. God gave us the ability to move our bodies. We can walk. We can run. We can move things. We're like, we're full of hinges, as the song says. We're all full of hinges. little kid's song. I have little kids, what should I say? dancing is not part of a bringing in from an outside source. You say, well, but it is outside source. No, it's not. Just because somebody else outside uses something does not mean that they are the source of it. God is the source of all things. Now, God instructs in Jeremiah that we will dance before him. And that is a positive thing that God instructs us to do. Yes, Jeff.
Yeah, because you know you could easily make that case from Egyptian history with circumcision. Because there's
right.
examples of circumcision in ancient Egypt.
Circumcision in ancient Egypt, referring to circumcision in ancient Egypt. You can take a lot of things from other cultures, just because they do something doesn't mean what you do becomes evil. We have a menorah. We celebrate on Shabbat. What if a pagan culture came and said, well, we're going to celebrate on Shabbat too? Does that mean we should not celebrate Shabbat anymore? Of course not. That's absurd. Shabbat has nothing. Celebrating Shabbat or on Shabbat has nothing to do with whether pagan takes it or not. It's, where did your source come from? Well, my source came from the Bible, God's instruction. What somebody else does, that's their business. Yes, Carrie.
It's actually kind of an interesting line of thought that I've been having conversations with God about this the last few weeks. Because I ran into a situation at the grocery store where there was some meat, and it was like, oh, this is Islamically slaughtered. And so it was like, okay, well, we can't eat that then. But it did kind of get me thinking, well, wait a minute. So we're not supposed to worship our God the way that other people worship theirs. But that right there is a prime example where we're basically doing the same thing. We've got a specific way of slaughtering animals, and it has to do with the worship of our individual gods. And so it really kind of made me think, a lot of the things that the other peoples of different religions do, they tend to be, especially like pagan types, they tend to be twistings of things that God has already given special place.
Generally, yes.
Like, you know, for example, like the prostitution in the temples. You know, God doesn't say you can't have relations. He just says this is when you have relations.
Yeah. Married,
You know, so the pagans people. Were, you know, using something he actually instituted in a completely different way. So do believers in God not have relations? No, we just have it in a specific way that he ordained. So that's kind of where, you know, I'm starting to recognize, oh, there are actually a lot of things that we do that are the same or similar. It's just that God chooses the setting for how we do it.
Right.
Or when.
That is generally true. But there are very few things that, well, if we did things too much differently, we would all be dead. So we wouldn't procreate. A lot of things we wouldn't do. Yes, Tammy.
And actually, halal slaughter, on that topic in particular, is something of a co-opting or a copying of kosher slaughter.
It's an alternation of kosher slaughter, yes.
Yeah, so it is. It's not exactly the same as kosher slaughter, but it is a form of it. So are we going to give up kosher slaughter because the Muslims are trying to copy it?
But do the Muslims do it the same as God does, right?
No, they do it differently. They do it a little different. It's not a lot. It's close. Yes, halal is marked on most packages, on most meat packages you buy at the store. Not that you have to be. You can choose what you want to eat. But the halal. Halal. H-A-L-A. How do you spell that?
H-A-L-A-L.
Thank you. Halal. Yeah. Two L's? Whatever. Let me spell a little symbol on it. Halal slaughter is a variation of kosher slaughter. They have to pronounce Allah's name over it. That's part of the rules. They have to face Mecca when they kill it. Halal slaughter, however, unlike kosher, does allow one additional methodology that kosher does not allow. I forgot it. It's a stick. I forgot the name of the stick. But anyway, it's a stick that they kill the animal. I'm going to draw a cow, the side profile, because they only use it for cows. Okay, it's not a good artist. Who cares? It's a cow. Here's a bushy tail. It's a fly, okay? It's killing a fly. Okay, it's a dog. So, the heart of an animal, a cow, is relatively deep, fairly good size. Okay, that's enough. So, halal or a Muslim slaughter, you must face the animal. It's just a stupid little rule. They have really rules. And they kill, they slit the throat, I hear, but they also take a stick and plunge it through the chest to poke the heart. And that's because their goal is to kill the animal as quickly as humanly possible. And so their goal, there's a name for the stick. I can't think of what it's called. But anyway, they do that. It's a halal slaughter. It's a methodology of killing the animal as fast as they can. What was that? Well, one could argue cruelty. So is bolting a head on. Is that cruel? You can discuss cruelty. But halal slaughter, it allows few things that kosher does not. There is no specification that God says you cannot poke an animal's heart. Doesn't say that, but it doesn't tell you what you can and can't do. So whether it's done or not, doesn't matter. Pronouncing Allah's name on it, that's your business if you want to eat it or not.
That's the thing, knowledge.
That's your business. Some have issues because they consider offering to demons because Allah, and you don't eat things offered to demons. On the other hand, there's no other God but God himself, and so anything offered to demons is garbage anyway. It's just an empty word. But then others say, well, but Allah could be Satan himself. You know, you decide what you think is good, what you think is not, and you decide you eat it and enjoy and be good with that. Yes.
Is that an idolatry?
It's halal, it's idolatry? It is contrary to the instruction given, but also realize that Allah isn't anything. It's a demon, at best, or just an idol. So it's really, you have to decide what you want, what you believe, how your stance is. Each person, each family makes their own decisions. If you go to a restaurant, there's like a 99% chance it's halal meat because they own and run all the slaughterhouses in the U.S. They're all Muslim run. They're the operators because they want to make sure there was enough halal meat available for everybody. So all the poultry houses, all the slaughterhouses for cattle, for sheep, for goat, they're all halal. Now, you can say, okay, I won't eat meat anymore. That's go ahead. Whatever you want to do. I'll only kill it myself. Go right ahead. What do you want to do? From you and God, it's your business. Yes, Carrie.
Well, I was just saying that's basically what Paul says. And I can't remember where it is, but Paul kind of addresses this issue of, you know, there's meat in the marketplace and you either buy it or you don't, or you raise your own and then you know, or whatever, you know. And my understanding, I think some other people understand it differently sometimes, and that's okay. But my understanding is kind of, if you know about it, stay away from it, especially if somebody's going to witness it, because they'll be like, wait, I thought that your God was this guy. You know, if you don't know about it, what do you do?
Right.
So, you know.
Yes, they can search for it.
Yeah, it's interesting. The Aramaic word for God is Allah.
Uh-huh. It is. That's the word for God.
Aramaic.
Yep, yep, yep. It comes from Eloi, which is the Hebrew spelling of the word. The Semitic languages use very, very similar pronunciations. Yes.
Recently, the school system wants to bring in halal foods for the children, and I thought that then if this is as you say that the slaughterhouses are all run by Muslims anyway, then it's all halal already. Then what's the point
generally,
of making
yeah.
the children have to right go through that Islamization or whatever?
If a child's parents, a child's concerned, don't eat somebody else's food, it's not that hard. If you're concerned, address it and fix it. It's not difficult. For example, my wife, myself, for other reasons, it's mostly for money, we buy our own animals and we have it killed a particular way by a particular person who doesn't use that method. Not because we're against the method, because it's cheaper. It costs a whole lot less to buy a cow than it does to buy individual cuts from a supermarket. The cow's like $3, $4 a pound versus I'm paying, you know, for grass-fed organic meat, you know, sometimes $20 a pound at the supermarket. This, I have the cheaper route. We do the same thing with our chickens too, because we buy it in bulk. We have a lot of kids. We buy large quantities of stuff. So we don't eat the halal meats, not simply because they are or are not halal, but just because it's a whole lot cheaper to go the other route than we do. But each person has to make their own decisions, what they want to do. You have to decide what you want to do, and you decide, hey, does this matter to me or does it not? Is this important to me or is it not? It may or may not be. The one thing I can guarantee you, if you eat pork, there's no such thing as halal pork. A lot of good that does us. What's that?
Why is it that public school systems, it seems like they're instilling, like, well, I mean, what's next? They're accepting all these Muslim type.
I won't go into politics today, I'm sorry. I'm not going to politics as to why. There are a lot of reasons, a lot of details going on. I'm getting myself hung up on some food details today. Yes, Carrie.
I was just thinking, I don't remember where it is, but there is a scripture in the prophets that said all your foods become unclean.
Right.
You know, and that's part of being in the diaspora.
Yeah, well, everything has its contamination. Let's move past our food issues, shall we? There's always lots and lots of food issues. A lot of people have issues with food.
We like food.
We all need food.
Yep.
If you're not informed, you can't make good choices. That's true. Hopefully, we'll get past the food. We have other things to cover. In particular, this next part, I'm going to skip some of the section. Let's see here. Okay, we're obvious. False prophets are false prophets. God has his rules about that, but there's instructions as far as witnesses and how the process works. I believe it's in John talks about, or 1 John talks about false prophets or false prophets among you. Just because something comes true, the false prophet, doesn't necessarily mean the false prophet becomes true. You have to pay attention to a false prophet is not whether they perform a sign or a wonder. What's the difference between sign and wonders? Do you know the difference between sign and a wonder? A sign's here on earth, a wonder's up there. You see, for example, here's a good example. The blood moons will land on this holy day. That's called a wonder. Ooh, look, it's a wonder. The guy had nothing to do with it. He's just pointing out to you. A sign will be a miracle here on earth. Just because someone does a sign or a wonder or points something out in the sky doesn't mean they're worthwhile listening to. They're just pointing out something that they did. God wants you to pay attention. What do they teach? What words coming out of their mouth? That defines what they are. Yes?
Oh, okay. I wanted to ask... Oh, it's okay. Sorry, my eyes are...
It's okay.
Glasses. I want to ask signs and wonders. Now, when the person's long dead, how does that... the person has to be living. I can't say, okay, 100, 200 years ago, Mr. or Mrs. So-and-so said this and that was going to happen. If it comes to pass... I mean, is it in their generation or is it for all time now?
It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter what time it happens. Many of our prophets that we have in the Bible discuss things that didn't happen in their lifetime. That happened many, 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 many years later. But they weren't instructing us away from God. They're still telling us what's going to happen many, many years from now. In some cases, thousands of years later. So the future time isn't defined. what matters is, does that prophet or individual teach you to go toward God and his instructions or away from God? Now, here's the complex thing. I can call God Bob number one or Bob number two, who cares what in hell his name is, and I tell you two things about him. Am I truly telling you about God or not? If I say, I'm just two different gods, all right? But I'm going to call him the same name. Yeah. I call him the same. Oh, it's the same God. It's all the same God. Here's method number one of talking to him, or teaching him, or following him, and method number two. How do you know whether I'm teaching the false God or not? It's the scripture. You have to verify. Just because a prophet says, you want to follow God, you want to follow Jesus, follow me, go do this. And the guy says, the Bible doesn't tell us to do that. But the guy said following Jesus, but the Bible doesn't tell you how you did it. What this gentleman is telling you to do is not the methodology God said to do. Therefore, what he's telling you to do isn't right. Not his final words, follow Jesus. It's the methodology. It's the words, the method, how you get there. That's what defines it. Because people perverted, in the Bible itself talks about it a few times, perverted God's name and twisted, took his name and put it on a whole lot of different stuff. Look at this cow, that's God. Look at this snake, that's God. And using his name to label it. That doesn't mean it becomes him. Oh, you must bow to this cow. You must bow to that altar. You must do it this way because God said so. Well, wait a minute. The instructions given say you will not worship him in this method. So when we discuss the false prophets, false teachers, what is being taught? Not the end goal, the workaround. Say, oh yeah, you're all following God. No, you're not. It's the methodology God cares about. How you get there. Yes, Susanna.
Is that astrology?
Astrology.
Like idolatry, you know, a chicken, year of the cow.
Right, all those details.
Giving your strength.
None of those match God's instruction. God measures things when it comes to astrology and those, which I admit I'm very naive in most events and things. But as far as like the month you're born in or this or that or other, none of those were instructions that God gave us to follow or make any sense. God gave us a counting of time and what time means, what it doesn't mean. And he counts years in sets of seven. So every 7 years, it's a repeat. And then up until you get to 50 years, then it restarts and counts sets of seven. So whatever year, if you're born the first set of seven, the second set of seven, year number one, two, or seven, who cares? Whatever it is, God set those sets of seven. As far as the months, God named the months. What they mean, what they don't mean, anything else that he's instructed us is what we add to it. Don't add or subtract. So when it comes to somebody, well, I'm a underborn or this month, the sign of such and such. Well, I'm over this sign of such and such and such. Well, our personalities are all different. You could argue the same thing. Well, I'm born under the parasha number Re'e that week. Well, I'm born under the parasha Shofatim. They're a week different. Well, what's the difference between choosing a parasha versus choosing anything else? You're choosing an arbitrary distinction that says, well, because I'm born at this week, that this is my parasha forever. Okay, maybe it is. That's maybe God's decision. His parasha is every single week. The whole week, every born that week is the same. Wow. You know, it's arbitrary that humans add to things. And we like to add to stuff in general. The cycles God gave us are set. They're set in 7 year cycles. The months cycles are 12 to 13 month cycles. And they are groups of seven. Whether it's a first set of seven, a second set of seven. He breaks them up in that way. What they mean astrologically, thank you, is regardless of anything as far as what God did not use those bodies in heaven to determine our outcomes. Yes.
Kat. I was just going to say, we don't follow the Hebrew calendar. We're completely westernized. So, I mean, astrology is even more confusing because there's a Hebrew calendar.
If you use God's Hebrew calendar, astrology would have a whole lot more complexity to it because the Hebrew calendar shifts as the years go by, while astrology always the same. Meaning I always see the stars this time, this position, every year. It's always this time, this month. While the Hebrew calendar moves. Oh, guess what? That was a month earlier. Because the year always moves based on the seasons. When the spring is, when it's not. So astrology would, as you put that correctly, would fix itself to a Gregorian calendar because it's a solar-based calendar. It is completely meaningless to a Hebrew calendar, which is agricultural-based. Agricultural-based calendars shift a full month forward and backwards. So every year you could be 3 weeks later or 2 weeks later or a month earlier. Who knows? And so Hebrew calendars, and God set the Hebrew calendars, if you're going to use any kind of methodology of determining what it means to you, you'd have to use a Hebrew calendar to do it. Not an the other word. Yes,
kind
Carrie.
Of a side note, and obviously we need to move on, but there is, they do call it the Maserot, and there are Aramaic and Hebrew names of stars inside the constellations.
There are.
And it does actually tell the plan of salvation. There's research on that.
There is discussion of it.
And there, and the even the word zodiac is actually a Greek transliteration of the Hebrew word zodi, mm-hmm. which means path. And the, it's the path that the earth travels in. So at certain times of the year, we can see certain constellations in certain places where they're in different places or we can't see them other times of the year. For example, the one that I remember the best is that the constellation that that normally the drawing resembles a ram, that always we can always see that in a particular place at the time of Passover. So they are there is some research that shows that biblically, you know, there is the plan of salvation
use
written
of
in the
them.
Stars.
Right.
And like the Psalms say, the heavens declare the glory of God. It doesn't say they tell us about our personalities.
No, right. It declares, our ideal
the
mates.
Glory of God. So there is some biblical research on that, but it's totally related to God's glory and his plan for us, not our personalities or if we mesh well with other personalities or that's a total human kind of deceptive twisting of that.
Tried to develop a purpose behind it. Right. Let's move forward. Any questions far? A little forward a little bit here. Let's see here. Details. One thing that was brought up, a question was brought up to talk about now. It had to do with the tithing issues in the third year and all that details and stuff. So I'll draw us to a board real quick. So, I have taught this a few times in the past, and I have made mistakes in it, and I've also made corrections and all that stuff all the time, but generally it's pretty much the same. So, I mentioned before, God broke his years, his cycles up into sets of seven, and then of course, obviously, there's 7 years and then seven sets of years for Jubilee years. So, there's a first year, there's a second year, there's a third year, there's a fourth, a fifth, a sixth, and then a seventh. Most of these cycles are broken up pretty consistently. There's a few exceptions when it comes to Jubilee. They do sets of sevens. There's one here, there's two of them, three, four, five, six, and seven. All these sets of seven, and then at the seventh set, the seventh day, draw seven correctly, the seventh set, which would be seven over here, it comes Jubilee, which is the 50th day, which is also the same year as number one for the new set. So that's how it's all broken up into these sets. And they continue on, and you can do the math and yada, yada, yada. Right, the year 29 is year 50, and that year 50 is also year one of the new set. So God breaks it up. So after year 49, after year 49 is year 50, which is also year one of the new set, the next set. So that's how it works. They're the same year labeled twice. Yeah, so you have to bring the 50-year all over again. So it says, I've taught this incorrectly in the past. My father corrected me a couple years ago, but I'll teach it correctly this time. The third year, the complexity is in Hebrew. It is interpreted as being every third year, but the text just says the third year. Well, and then it immediately goes on to sets of seven, discussing, well, it's the seventh year you will do this. So he points out, hey, if the text says in the third year you keep all your tithes and feasts and such locally, then it's not referring to every third year. It's referring to the third year, which is year number three, all the way down the set. So this year and that one and that one, all the, year number three, you keep a feast and all your holy days locally. That does not mean every third year, because that would also include the sixth of this year, but then number three, the following year would be number two. And then we are number five, and then the following year, we're number one. It'd be really confusing if you did every third year. It wouldn't make any sense. And God's not the author of confusion. He's very consistent. So it wouldn't make any sense to every third year, but rather it is the third year, which is exactly what the Hebrew text specifically states. The third year. So the third year, it's local holidays. I say local because it says you will store up your tithes, your offerings, within your gates, that the orphan, the fatherless, the poor, well, orphan, fatherless, the same thing, the widow, all, and the Levites in your gates, all in your area will come and eat and have their fill in this particular year. In the other years, year 1, 2, 4, 5, 6, and 7, you don't. The local is not the not the requirement. God did not specify local. He said you will attend my holy days. You will not come empty-handed 3 times a year, yada, yada, yada. All that would apply on all of the other holy days. So year 3, by God's command, you keep your feasts and such local. All the other holy days, by God's command, you keep wherever he put his name. You can argue where that is. Some say Jerusalem, some say Timbuktu, nowhere, whatever. Wherever it is, the other years, you don't keep it that way. And you have to ask yourself this simple question. Why? Well, let's think what happens here. We're humans, right? So we usually try to figure out what is this cause. The reason for local, it says those who are poor, the widow, fatherless, the Levite who's in your gates, the proselyte, who else was it? Sojourner? I think who else was rattled off? A few other people, individual people. Can any of them go to the other feasts for the rest of the years? Well, do poor people have enough money to go to Jerusalem? Not generally. 3 times a year? Not likely. That's expensive. Check the plane tickets out. Just do the math. Yeah. Any of the holy days. Jerusalem. Good luck. Yeah. Thousands of dollars to get there and come back again. And that's just for, just the plane ticket alone, because it's all booked. Everybody goes there. But what does it do to those poor individuals, the widow, the fatherless, all that stuff, when you don't show up for the third year? Let's say, for example, let me rephrase this a little differently. Let's say a congregation in place wherever all went to Jerusalem the 3 times a year that year. So let's say we pretend we're year number 2, or the cycle number 2. We all went to Jerusalem the 3 times a year. The poor people in our congregation stayed home. The widows, if they weren't worth the bullet to go, stayed home. The Levites, they didn't have nobody to go, stayed home. All of them stayed home. Do any of them get to observe the feast in Jerusalem? No. In the third year, they all celebrate with you. You're with them. You interact with the feasts and all the holy days. They're all celebrated together as a group or community. You also get to discuss and talk about all the wonderful things you saw in Jerusalem, to those poor and the widows and everybody else and the fatherless. And the following year, you're going again. And all those poor and the widow fatherless aren't. What does it invoke to the poor, the fatherless, and the widow? Jealousy. Bingo. God is a jealous God, isn't he? He made the jealous emotion inside of all humans. It wasn't by accident. It's on purpose. Because when these individuals who get to go, they've saved their tithes over the years, they've done their work, their due diligence to keep their tithes set aside in order that they may go, it invokes jealousy on those who didn't. They strive more. When a person's jealous, I want that. What are you likely to go do? Work for it. Do it. You're likely to go do it. God's objective is to get these individuals to go. And what better way to do it than emotionally attach them to want to go? It's extremely effective. Anybody ever dealt with a jealous person before? Very powerful. Very strong emotion. Well, God said, hey, here's a taste, year 3. Now everybody, go. Make sense? Now, in this same cycle, as we discussed, it also says the year of release, of year number 7. In Judaism, they argue that year 6 and 7, you stay home also because no one tithes on year 7 or year 50, so they couldn't possibly go. That's not true. It specifies tithing, which is in Leviticus 26, I think it is. I think it's 26. The tithing has to do with what is being tithed and how it's tithed. You also, the year of release, the year of resting the land, the farmers don't harvest their crops in that 7th year, has to do with crops. Crops like in, here's wheat, here's barley, here's wine, here, the crop that you would harvest. It has nothing to do with cell phone manufacturers. God didn't say, cell phone manufacturers, you will not manufacture cell phones in the year 7. No, he doesn't. He doesn't say cattle ranchers. You will not have cattle. No cattle is allowed to give birth in year 7. Yeah, good luck with that. Chickens. No one's allowed to lay an egg in year 7, chickens. Good luck with that. What happens to the animal growers? Well, animals still grow. Go look around. They still like each other and they still mate. They don't stop. It doesn't matter what year 7 is. The point is, it's the land that rests, not the entire economy. Now, it all specifies that those who are creditors, credit cards included, who offer credit, you are not to, you are to release the debt owed to someone who observant or following of God. It also happens in year 7. It's Gentiles, those who have no use for God. It says that you do not have to release their debt. Those who have a use for God, which is non-Gentile, meaning someone who believes in him, you must release the debt. But it also specifies those who believe in God, you are not to charge interest. So whether you release the debt or not, it doesn't matter. You didn't lose anything. You just lost a principal. There's no interest to gain anyway. So your financial institution didn't lose money, as far as didn't lose their income. Their income stayed the same. They just lost their principles, which is a little different. Yes.
Is that like when he talks about that you can't pick the fruit off of a tree? Doesn't like a big tree, fruits, trees?
Right. The fruit trees
included. The third year, right?
That has to do with how a tree's growing. When a tree's first planted, it's its first seedling, it grows. In the third year, you don't touch it. The fourth year, it's given. I forgot the rules. I think the third year you leave the tree to rest. The fourth year you give it up to God. The fifth year it's all yours. But the trees produce fruit from the fifth year onward. The fifth, sixth, seventh, they're still producing fruit, eighth, ninth, all the way through. That is a separate issue because God says whatever grows of itself, go ahead and eat. Don't harvest it and sell it. That's what you don't do. Don't harvest it and sell it in the seventh year. You don't have to harvest what the fruit from that tree is and then go sell it to somebody and make money off it. You can give it away to someone who is poor. That was the instruction. The poor can come and take as they wish. But as you do not sell to make money off of it. Some have argued, well, can I just break even? No. I'm discussing breaking even. Well, I'll sell it at a slight loss. No. That's garbage. Thank you. It's just how it works in that cycle. So in this process, which I meant to earlier during our announcement section regarding the feasts this year, we have been making feasts, local feasts, for the past, at least past 10 years, here local, accessible to anybody who was poor. Yes, John.
Don't get mad at me for asking.
Go ahead.
So how do you know which year you're in? How
Simple.
Do we know which
yep.
year we are
Not
in?
Not a problem. God took care of that for us. Currently, this year is set 1, also happens to be year number 7, 50. It's our Jubilee year this year, and it starts and ends, let me specify. It was announced or proclaimed the following year will be a Jubilee last fall. It was proclaimed on...
Last fall?
It's officially proclaimed on Atonement, but everybody knew about it, because it wasn't genius work to calculate the math. Knew about it beforehand. But it's proclaimed, the year cycles, whether you're in year 1, 2, 3, 4, what year it is it declared an atonement every year, openly declared. So this past year, an atonement, it said that, hey, we are going into the 50th of Jubilee year. There's a few individuals who disagree with that, but most are really easy to prove incorrect. So 50th year, we're in a Jubilee year right now, which is also year number 1 right now. Yeah, the Shemitah cycle is here, was our 49. That completed. Now, God says your years start and end in the spring, which is at Aviv. Now, but they are declared 6 months earlier at Atonement, which they're telling everybody, hey, everybody, next year in spring is our whatever, whether it's our 7th year or our 50th year. And the reason it's declared at Atonement tells everybody, don't plant anything. Because you can't harvest it. Don't bother. Because when you're going to harvest, let's pretend you're going to harvest, what's a spring crop? Barley. Fair. You harvest barley. You're a barley farmer. You grow barley. Well, if you know you can't harvest it, There's nothing to harvest come springtime when barley's growing because it's either a Shemitah year or it's a Jubilee year. Are you going to spend the money to plant barley? Probably not. That wouldn't be a very wise use of your money. You're literally throwing away for pigs to eat. That would be silly. So you would want to know ahead of time, in this case atonement, 6 months roughly earlier, oh, okay, I won't plant barley. I won't plow my fields. I won't prep them. I won't get them ready for the harvest, because that wouldn't make any sense, because I can't harvest it anyway. So it's declared an atonement, and it lasts all the way through, but it starts and ends in the spring. So this year, from 2 weeks before Passover, this past year, was our Jubilee year began. And that's when it starts. It will end in 2 weeks before Passover next year, which I think is in April. Generally, yeah. It's really not that complicated to calculate backwards. You can actually see patterns of behavior throughout world history on the 7 and 50-year cycles, which many people have written books about that. Say, hey, there's a 50 and 70-year cycle. And most are pretty consistent in the last 150 years or so, roughly. The pattern has been very well distinct and very well marked. So they're pretty consistent with this. And if this is Jubilee year, it matches Messiah's year when he was killed for his Jubilee year. So which also, again, if you do the math backwards, since it lands in the exact same year, it's probably right. Most likely. So they've been pretty consistent. There are some subtle differences and differences of opinions, but most of them are pretty well shot through that. So this is year 50 for us, also known as year 1, which is here. Yeah. Now, this is not just our personal congregation, actually many congregations. This is year 1. Most of them have pointed that out the past 10, 15 years. They've noticed, hey, they started to notice cycles in their own congregations and noted, hey, we're leaning toward this before most of the books were published about this being a Jubilee year. So we're currently in year number 1 for our congregation, and many others are also in year number 1. Most of the Sukkot sites you will see online today that are coming up this coming fall, all of them point out, hey, Jubilee Sukkot this year, because all these various congregations throughout the whole U.S. are realizing this is our Jubilee Sukkot this year, because they spot out it's pretty evident that's what it is. Hopefully that makes sense. So as I mentioned before, last 10 years, All Fellowship has done a local feast site. We've been not stuck. We've been focusing on our year 3 concept over and over again for people who are poor and such. And it was pointed out to me by my dad a week and a half ago. Said, Daniel, don't make the same mistake I did. This was dumb. Don't make a local Sukkot for individuals who will never get their jealousy to say, I want to go somewhere else. You circumvented God's instruction. Oh, good point. You see, if I always, or we, or a congregation always does this, is there any incentive for people to do anything else? For the poor to say, hey, I want to go to wherever, where God places his name, somewhere else? No, there isn't. Is there incentive for anybody to actually strive to go beyond staying local? Other than boredom. Not really. So he pointed out to me a week and a half ago and said, this wasn't the wisest choice. That God's instruction makes a whole lot more sense. So that's why I discussed earlier that Sukkot's a little bit up in the air this year as far as we had to cancel the one site because there was no point in putting a Sukkot on for a family and a half, two families. That seems silly. And discuss what the options are and what we will deal with that. And we'll take care of that probably soon. In the next couple of days or so, what the options are for people. Because we're technically in year number 1 for the cycle. And I mentioned back in springtime this year, back at Passover, that it might be wise for some of us to go find other places for Sukkot this year. Not because of this. I wasn't thinking about this. I was just thinking the fact that it was period of border. But anyway, so that's the details. We'll discuss more details on options and what the plan is. Whether or not we have a Sukkot local, what will wind up being is the hall here will probably be left open. Not meaning unlocked. Meaning somebody will have holy days here available for those who wish to attend locally, for those who did not plan or cannot afford to go. And we probably will have, or encourage individuals to find sites to go visit and explore and see and understand, that encourage them to gather what God wishes for them to understand and learn about His ways. The one thing I wanted to point out to each one of us in this process is that it's wherever God places His name, but where He places His name for me might not be the same place He places His name for you. Like anybody. If anybody has, hey, I feel compelled to go to this place, then God's telling you, go that place. Or I feel compelled to go this over here, then God's telling you, go over there. I'm compelled to stay local, then God's telling you, stay local. So where God places His name is based on individual families, where God is placed, where God's telling me I should go here versus I should go there. That's where it should be anyway. But except in the third year, like you're not, you know, anchor yourselves. Find a place and anchor hard, because that's what God said. You will stay local in the third year and you will celebrate with those who you are with every single week or every year as we're in your communities. Does it make sense so far? Yes, Susanna.
Once every 7 years, the third year, because...
Yep.
Okay.
Yep, it'd be a third year. Each set of seven, we always do the third year, which you would require to stay local. That is not saying God won't say to somebody, hey, Joshua number two, you should stay local on year five, because I'm telling you, you need to stay local on year five. That's their business. That's the point. God put that, tell that person, I put my name here, you're going to stay here. Joshua Shmo stays local number five. The point is, God's instruction was the whole community stays local on year number three. Does that make sense?
Is that
It's not bad behavior. It's according to what God blessed you with. You see, I may not know why He tells me to stay local on year four, but He did. Was I a bad person? I don't think so. Hopefully not. God willing, I wasn't. But I may not know that year number four, there's Shmuley is going to stop by. And he needs to talk. He wants to communicate and learn about God. And I'm going to meet him. I'm staying local year four. I don't know it. But it'll happen. See, I don't know why. I can't tell why. I just have to do. Does it make sense? So God may say, Shmuley's going to meet you. He's not going to tell me that, but he knows. He's going to meet you local at this feast site in year number four. Don't go anywhere. So, I don't know why, but I don't go away. And then all of a sudden Shmuley shows up. Oh, who are you? I'm Shmuley. Oh, nice to meet you, Shmuley. Here's my instructions. And what do you want to know? What do you want to teach me? What do I need to teach you? See, I don't know the reasons of why God puts His name someplace for one family versus another. But He still does. You can notice that on the Sukkot site throughout the whole U.S., there's one in Roland Lake, which isn't too far from about a 3-hour drive. From here, there's also, obviously, there's like two or three of them up in Oregon. There are people are running. There's a couple of them here, rest of California as well. They're all different sites. They all do two things differently. And it's okay. But each person has their own desire to go one site versus another site. And we all learn things differently when we go there. Yes, Carrie.
Kind of like Richard and Ellie putting a sukkah up at a Christian Halloween party.
Right.
And meeting three Shmuleys.
Yes. Exactly. Exactly. A Christian Halloween party. Why would you go there? You wouldn't. That's silly. But you put a sukkah up, that's absurd. But yet, and yet, God still said, put a sukkah up. And they felt compelled to do so, and they did. And guess what happened? They met people that they would have never met before. God drew that person, said, here, come here, talk to this individual. See, why something happens is very difficult to determine ahead of time. We usually, God doesn't open our eyes as to why until after it already happened. We realize, oh, duh, that's why. But until it happens, we don't get to know. It just is. So if God tells somebody else to stay home on year number two or five or seven or six, that's His decision. He says, hey, I want you to go this place over there on year four, and you go that place over there on year two, and you stay here on year six. That's God's decision. And each family does their own thing. So based on this philosophy, I am recalculating out my own head what my family should or shouldn't do, what each one of us as family members should or shouldn't do, and what is and isn't available. Don't get me wrong. This hall will be open as long as I'm present at Grange, and I am so far, until at least November. Will be open during the holy days. I, my family may or may not be here, but somebody will be here to open up during the holy days. God willing. This coming October. I will be here for we're referring to Sukkot, Sukkot in particular. Okay, so we'll discuss those details as time progresses. Any questions so far? I'm trying to learn, just like everybody else is, when somebody points out a mistake that I've done for years, much like this details of counting and locals, I may not understand it at first, but I have to learn and correct when I'm taught correctly. So this is part of my learning process too. Just learn with me. And don't be mad at me when I learn and make mistakes. So learn with me. This is how we're learning. Let's see here. Okay, the seventh year of release, I mentioned it earlier, let me erase this. You guys don't need this up anymore, right? Hopefully not. In chapter 15, it discusses a lot about the year of release. I'm officially going to call it quits, though, because we have a new moon to go through. New moon to go through later on. I'm already over time a little bit. So, year of release, I already mentioned previously, though, that about the creditors and how that process works. If you're a creditor and you loan money to a fellow believer in God, you don't charge him interest anyway. So if you have to release the money by year 7, you didn't lose your income. I'm referring to creditor referring to like banks, credit card issuers, and car loan issuers, and house loan issuers. Those details, you don't charge interest anyway. So if you obeying God's law, it's not a major loss of your income. But, of course, those who has no use for God, doesn't believe him, doesn't follow him, debts and interest rates are perfectly acceptable to charge, and that's considered normal or agreed upon. Jewish philosophy, not say right or wrong, just philosophy, believes that if it's a loan based on collateral, it's never to be released until it's paid off. If it's a loan not based on collateral, it should be released. That's in Jewish philosophy, Jewish opinion. I'm not saying they're right or wrong, that's just their opinion. And the reason as a result, that looks like a credit card, for example, is not collateral-based. You have to release that, or a personal loan, versus, you know, a house or a car loan that's collateral-based, you wouldn't release it. You know what? It's Jewish philosophy on how they're trying to work with the releasing debts and not losing money. It's a philosophy. It's not spelled out in the Torah regarding that detail, okay? It specifies that debts that you loaned out, the debt is released. That's what it is. Let's see here. And of course, obviously, chapter 16 rehashes out some of the basic concepts of the pilgrimage feasts of Passover, the Feast of Weeks, and of course, Sukkot, which is coming up to us next month. Any questions? Yes, John.
I'm kind of intrigued by the point that is made. Going back to the canceling of debts,
yes.
About the human nature part of us, where we tend, sometimes we would tend to think about how close
right.
the day is.
How much money are we going to lose?
Yeah, and God says, uh-huh. Don't do that.
Yes, don't do that. Do give him what he needs. Yes, there's this. It's not easy to break our human nature. It just isn't. Now, some of us will just say, well, we're not going to give loans out. Well, that's not necessarily fair. The person needs something. They need whatever it may be. Maybe it's a crazy amount of money, too. $100,000, I need tomorrow, and you have it. Wow. And you need tomorrow because it's whatever reason. But your release is two days later. Who cares? You need it tomorrow. So that's the way it is. It's not easy, but it's a contrary of our human instinct. Yes, Tammy?
Well, I usually just say to people, if you can't afford to give it away, don't loan it.
Right.
Just presume. Anytime somebody says, oh, I need to borrow $100, I'll pay you back. If you have $100 sitting in the bank and you give it to them, just consider it a gift in your head. If they pay you back the $100, then that's just gravy.
Right.
Because
don't talk. Right.
Otherwise, your life will be difficult and miserable. And
yep. What is too short for that? What has gotten a number of people in that process of loaning, which this happens a lot to parents and their semi-adult children. So I need this money. I really need money for this. I don't have enough money for it. And the parent says, well, I'm looking at my bank account. I don't have a lot, but I'll write you. I will go into debt to help you. Wrong move. The parent doesn't go into debt to help a child. That's backwards. In that, because you are not giving them your money. You're giving them somebody else's money.
Oh,
You take it for the bank and give the bank that the kid's money under your name. Wait. He didn't say, you shall loan them your debt so that they will be even the year of lease. He didn't say loan them your debt. He said loan them your money. If I either have it or I don't have it, honey, you need $100,000. I have $4. I'm not going to go to the bank and say, please give me $999,996 in order to give them to you because it's not my money. And instead of going to me, you should have gone to the bank directly because it's their money, not mine. I only have $4. Now, don't get wrong. This is difficult for most parents. It catches every parent that I know of when their children are older, but college debt, but they're starting out, all that. This is the difficulty. It's not easy to do. Debt is debt, and debt is not the same as money. Debt is the same as money to a bank, but not to an individual. We don't loan our debt out to somebody. You loan the money you have to somebody. Yes?
What about children whimsically asking for money? I mean, are you as a parent, are you required?
Well, if you have the money and they're asking you, it's out of the goodness of your heart. They're asking for money. It's when you don't have the money and they're asking and you go through a bank and get it.
I understand that. But I'm talking about whimsical needs.
Oh.
Right? I'm talking about, you know, adult children who
right.
want everything given to them.
Right. Yeah, if you answer your question, the idea of whimsical.
In other words, I don't take the guilt trip. You know,
I can't instruct somebody on their parenting style to their child. But if my child comes to me and says, Dad, you know, I really need... my kids are young, okay? Their needs are cheap. I really need this new Lego set that costs, you know, $55, and I only have $3. Can I please get it? I look at that. Wait a minute. Look at these 400 Lego sets you have at home. To me, this is not a need. This is truly a want. There's a difference. You want it, that's fine. Go next door, work for him. You need money. Work for the neighbor, do his yard, take care of his dog, whatever it is. Save your money and go buy it yourself because it's a want. Rather than a need. When he's referring to people who are in need, like people who are poor, the poor person isn't asking you, well, I can't pay my cell phone bill this month. Sorry, cell phone is a want, not a need. So don't pay it. There's a difference between wants and needs. When a poor person goes, I can't feed my children. Okay, that's a different story. I'm being evicted, and I'm already in cheap rent. I can't go anywhere else. There's no place left that's cheaper. I don't have money to pay for it. That's going into the needs. Versus the wants. So we as human beings can distinguish what is a need versus what's a want. Yes?
As your faith, so be it unto you.
I'm sorry, say it a little louder.
As your faith is, so be it unto you.
That is a reasonable response you give to someone too. When someone says, I need this. Well, what's your faith? You need it. What is your faith? What is your faith means trust. What's your trust? What are you trusting in? Are you trusting in me that I have the money to give it to you? Interesting in God that has the money to or power to bless you or not. Now, at the same time, I have to have my hand open. It's available if you need it. And God may easily or happily bring somebody to me who needs something. And I have to be willing to offer it, whether the Shemitah cycle year happens 3 days later. I'm going to lose all the money or not. Who cares? They need it. And that is based on their faith and trust in God. In this cycle, which I already erased, because I would need it. And this year cycle, the poor people who would have no money in the year number 3, they can't go anywhere. Well, they also have their own needs, their own wants, their own desires. If I fulfill all their wants in year 3 and year 4 and year 5 and always fulfill their wants, they never put in themselves the effort to say, I'm going to take care of this and accomplish it for my own worship and trust of God. There's no reason for God to bless you if you don't ask for blessings. There's no reason for God to work with you if you're not willing to work with Him. Does that make sense? It's because if you have faith in God, that means you trust Him. You trust Him, you believe in Him. Okay, God, I am stuck in year 4. I can't afford to go to any of the feast sites. I didn't have enough money to go. Well, how much do I trust you? All right, God, year 5, help me go. Trust Him and let Him walk you through it. It's not easy. Those of you who don't save money, It's really hard. Just tell you. Those of you who are natural savers, you're not a problem. But those of you who don't save money, it's really hard. And God gave us instruction on how to save money for things. In particular, tithing. You save it. It's the tenth. It's not easy, but it's a lot easier to save a tenth throughout a year than it is to come up all at once the day that before the feast shows up. Just telling you, it really is. Yes?
I just wanted to clarify, I wasn't talking about my own children.
No, I would never assume. I'm sure they're innocent. I hope this made sense to you today, as far as what God's intent and his design was. Yes, Kat.
Go ahead, clarify. My understanding that year three, we're supposed to stay local for Sukkot, but all those other years, we're supposed to go where God tells
you to go.
Like Jerusalem, you're saying?
If he tells you to go to Jerusalem, I personally speaking, God has never told me to go to Jerusalem. He hasn't. Anytime I ask, should I go to Jerusalem? I look at the headlines and say, no way. I'll stay home. I'll go somewhere else. Because I have no desire to go. I just don't. Personally, I just don't. It's not a draw for me. To me, it's a city with lots of problems like every other city there is. To me personally, when God says, go here for a holy day or go there for a feast, it has to do with human beings that I'm with, not the location it's at. Say it again. The human beings, I'm not referring to, I want to go to the feast with you or you or you or you. No, I'm referring to the people that have gathered to this place. It is a welcoming place. It's a celebration of God. That's great. This place, I don't care where it's physically at. It's the people that are there. Are they worshiping God? Is it a place which I can be fed and enjoy and celebrate God with? If it's not, why would I go there? If it is, sure, that's a good place to go. Now, to me personally, God's never told me to go to Jerusalem. My parents got to go many years ago. Great. Good for them. God didn't tell me to go, so I don't. There's no reason to go yet. Maybe someday it will be, but not now. For you, however, God may say, go to Jerusalem. And thus you will go, because he said go. Or anybody else, for that matter. So wherever God places his name, the thing is that God has purposefully, he told us he had time he would do so, removed his name from Jerusalem. He did it in Messiah's time. He said, there will be some time where you will neither, Messiah said, you will neither worship God on this mountain or in Jerusalem. But to tell you that the place, location, is not there. God's not going to be there to put his name there for you to all worship him in Jerusalem or even on the mountain that she was at. That wasn't the point. You go in to go wherever God places his name, and it's a lot of different places. Look around us. Those who have seen or heard or encountered any individuals in many different feast sites throughout our country, throughout the whole world, there's lots of them. Is God at each of them? Yes, he is. Yeah, there are many places he is there. So if he's there, it's okay to go. Make sense? It doesn't have to be in Jerusalem. It can be in many different places. And there are lots of them to choose to select and choose from. You just figure, is God telling you to go to this place or to that place or to this place or to stay here or go wherever you're supposed to go? What's God telling you to do? That's for you and him. Does that make sense? Okay. Any questions or comments? I'm going to give you at least a 10-minute break. We'll give a mix of 5 and 10. And we'll do a new moon. It'll be a long time for this. The new moon prayers afterward. Close the prayer real quick, though. Almighty God, thank you for this time we study and worship and praise you. We ask you to bless us and guide us and teach us what is good and right. Please help us, Father, to learn what is fair and just, that we treat each other well, treat each other according to your way and not our own. May your will be done, not our will. Grant us peace, Father, and grant us a new moon, wonderful new moon celebration. In Yeshua's name, amen.
You've been listening to a discussion at Hallel Fellowship. If you would like to hear more discussions or if you have any questions, visit the website at hallel.info. That's hallel.info. Hallel.info.